You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 2nd of January 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Paul Osborne. On today's show, Islamic State claims it was behind the New Year's Eve attack on an Istanbul nightclub. Now, how will Turkey respond, and why is the country suffering so many terrorist attacks? The Russian diplomats expelled by the US have arrived home, but Moscow insists it won't retaliate. We'll try to work out what Vladimir Putin is up to. Something many of Europe's leaders are doing as well, but that's not the only issue they have to deal with in 2017. We'll look at rising anti-EU sentiment. And as the holiday season staggers to an end and you contemplate your overflowing inbox, we bring good news from France, the sworn enemy of work email. All that to come on Midori House with me, Paul Osborne. So welcome to the first Midori House of 2017. My guests in the studio today are Brian Klass, the London School of Economics, and John Everard, a former British ambassador to Belarus, Uruguay and North Africa. We're going to begin in Turkey, where the Islamic State group has today claimed that it was behind the attack on a nightclub in Istanbul, which killed 39 people on New Year's Eve. It says a heroic soldier was acting on its behalf, an attacker still at large as a huge manhunt continues. We are learning a little more about the attack itself. The gunman arrived in a taxi, rushing through the entrance and firing close to 200 bullets in just 7 minutes in a club where nearly 600 people were celebrating the beginning of the new year. John Everard, IS doesn't tend to claim responsibility for everything that happens. So do we believe it, first of all?
Well, I think the presumption is that, yes, this was an IS attack. On previous occasions, they've backed up their claims by releasing videos of the, quote, heroic soldiers, unquote, pledging allegiance to IS before the attack. They don't seem to have done so yet on this occasion. That may yet emerge. But certainly the Turkish authorities are treating the IS claim as genuine.
Brian, one of the things that was remarked upon on New Year's Day as more and more came out about this attack is that Turkey is struggling to contain any number of different issues. We have had mass casualty attacks that Kurdish separatists have claimed. We have had mass casualty attacks claimed by Islamic State. It has taken on an awful lot at the same time.
It has, and this is probably a wake-up call for them on how they're dealing with IS, because for a very long time, the Turkish approach to IS was the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And so IS fighting Assad in Syria and also, battling with the Kurds, there was a bit of light gloves being used by Erdogan's regime to deal with Islamic State. And I think that for a long time, that meant that Islamic State was also not striking within Turkey, but that has now changed. And so it will force Erdogan to reevaluate his strategy significantly going into 2017.
Now, it's interesting that, as you say, in August, it was what Turkey stepped up its intervention in Syria and directly began targeting IS. And before that, the IS strategy appeared to be to try to destabilize Turkey, but not to push it so far that it would feel it had to intervene more powerfully. Now, the Turkish military was effectively bragging over the Christmas period in media statements about just how many Islamic State fighters it had killed in northern Syria, which presumably IS will see as a provocation.
Yeah, and this is where I think Erdogan is being pushed into a corner where he has to respond aggressively. And so there's going to be several challenges to the Turkish state in 2017 between the Kurdish problem that they see as a major threat, the Islamic State, and also Assad being propped up again in Syria and re-entrenching his control over the country.
And John Everard, this is something that Erdogan has tried to portray himself as the strong man. Yeah. He has cracked down on his opponents. He has stepped up security measures. And yet you could lose count if you started to list the terrorist attacks in the last 12 months in Turkey. Just in December, we had the murder of the Russian ambassador at the gallery in Ankara, 44 people killed in an attack outside a football stadium, and then the New Year's Eve attack in Istanbul. Why, if Mr. Erdogan is such a successful hard man, is security so bad in Turkey?
I think if he portrays himself as able to stop IS attacks in their entirety, he is on a loser. IS are reasonably well organized, and they are adept at carrying out attacks or having attacks carried out on their behalf by small numbers of people, in this case, of course, just one gunman, lightly armed. All you need is one man and one weapon in the right place. In the words of the IRA at the height of the Northern Irish Troubles, the Turkish state has to win every time. IS only has to win once and Erdogan's in trouble.
How do you think the president will react to this? Because as you say, it's a very dangerous strategy to say, well, I'm now going to defeat IS because many have tried and so far not succeeded. So what do you do?
You do a lot of posturing. You try to convince the public that you are in control. And behind the scenes, you beef up your police, you increase patrols, you probably do quite a lot of extra stop and searching. But you know in your heart of hearts that this might well reduce the number of successful IS attacks. It's not going to eliminate them.
Turkish government officials, Brian, have said that this will not deter the intensified operation in Syria, but there is that issue of public willingness to support it if the violence is going to visit them at home.
Yeah, and this is, you know, Erdogan for a long time now has been increasing his authoritarian strategies. He's been trying to rule with an iron fist, and in particular, this ramped up after the attempted coup against the Turkish state. And so I think that the long-term problem for Erdogan is that as he increases this authoritarian bent without any yielding results, any sort of decrease of terrorism, he's going to be, you know, limited. He's going to have very few options left. In other words, it's not going to be enough to just use strongman rule. It's not enough to just increase police patrols or to just try to double down on intelligence when the real problem is there's so many divisions within Turkish society and he's facing so many simultaneous enemies that he can't really try to defuse the ticking time bomb that is facing Turkey in 2017.
And all this time, his economy is tanking, and he's facing rising public discontent because people are feeling the squeeze.
Now, of course, one issue behind that economic problem is that foreign tourists are very reluctant to travel to Turkey at the moment, and the concern then is that foreign investors and foreign businessmen will be equally reluctant to travel.
Yes, absolutely. It's a downward spiral. Turkey's international image, especially amongst the kind of people who might bring money in, is going downhill fast. And if this kind of attack goes on, and if Erdogan continues with his policies, it's not clear that that's going to change anytime soon.
Brian, this is part of a deliberate strategy, too. We've seen this before in Tunisia, for example, where there was attacks on museums, there was attacks on various areas where tourists would conglomerate. So this is something where IS is trying to hit the pocketbooks of government elites in tourism. And it's particularly important in countries like Turkey and Tunisia that used to rely on a significant percentage of their GDP from tourist revenues.
I want to pick up, Brian, something you said a moment ago about the increasing divergence in Turkish society. That prior to the attack on New Year's Eve, there were people criticizing just the kind of party that came under attack, saying it was un-Islamic, un-Turkish, something that shouldn't be happening. Now, while there's a world of difference between rhetorical criticism of something like that and somebody going in with a gun and shooting at people, there's a dotted line, as it were, that starts with that hard-line attitude that leads on to the kind of violence that you saw on New Year's Eve.
Yeah, this is a long pattern that has been happening for at least a decade in Turkey, where there's been a shift away from secular politics and a shift towards authoritarian, strongman Islamist politics. And so there's a rising tide in Turkey towards this type of rule. And it's not to say that, you know, you can connect the dots and say this is to blame or here's the smoking gun, but it has been a long-term shift. This didn't happen in the last week. And I wouldn't blame, you know, Erdogan specifically for this particular attack, but I would say that he is polarizing society by the way he's responding to security risks.
Now, in the refugee crisis, John, Erdogan made a series of demands of the European Union, chiefly financial, but appeared also to give the impression that he didn't really care what EU leaders thought of him. In taking a more active role against IS, he has put himself, as it were, back on side with a lot of EU leaders. If he wants to, could he call on them for a little more support?
I think that would be difficult. Clearly, I mean, the EU is glad of anybody who's fighting IS for obvious reasons. But the refugee crisis is still there. Those talks remain extremely difficult. And we still have poisoning the entire relationship. Turkey's by now almost certainly failed efforts to join the European Union. And one of the reasons that Erdogan was trying to show the European Union leaders that he didn't care what they thought of him was a kind of a schadenfreude, a wish to show that he didn't care in any case, you know, what they thought of a country that was not now going to join the European Union.
Now, Brian, that isolationism is a dangerous strategy for someone who's under attack from quite so many enemies.
Yeah, and I think this will only continue. I think that there's going to be potential new relationship that's formed between Trump and Erdogan, for example, because Trump seems to be less worried about the types of crackdowns that Erdogan is using. But other than that, Turkey has fewer and fewer friends as it continues to be more and more vulnerable in a very dangerous neighborhood.
Well, we're going to turn a little later to some of the challenges that are facing a number of European leaders. But first, let's go to Moscow, where dozens of Russian diplomats expelled from the US over alleged interference in the presidential election today returned to Moscow. 35 were thrown out after the White House said that cyber attacks targeting November's election were ordered at the highest levels of the Russian government. Now, we all know what happens next. The tit-for-tat expulsion is inevitable, except Vladimir Putin ignored the advice of his own foreign minister and said there would be no retaliatory action. Brian, instead of that, he invited the children of American diplomats to a Christmas party at the Kremlin. What on earth is he up to?
This is carefully orchestrated political theater, and there's no way that Lavrov in saying we're going to respond and then Putin saying we're not, that was any surprise to Putin. Putin decided to do this to make himself look like the good cop in a good cop, bad cop relationship. But let's remember, both of them are bad cops. You don't give anyone a prize or a criminal a prize for committing a crime and then taking the high road afterwards. So the reason why Obama responded was because the Russian government was involved in hacking U.S. officials in a way aimed at influencing U.S. elections. So the fact that he didn't respond to our response to that is not something you praise. It's something where he tried to look like he was taking the high road when in fact he had taken the low road from the beginning.
And John, if that was the intention,
also,
it kind of
say quite a nasty, a snide way of showing that the Russian security services know where the American diplomats' children are.
True.
Yeah,
that's quite a dark way of interpreting that. What is meant to be, on paper at least, some sort of friendly, come celebrate Christmas,
friendly gesture.
Looks like we know where you live.
No, this Brian is absolutely right. This is carefully orchestrated political theatre. This is the smile on the face of the tiger. Putin is trying to come across as the good guy. It's quite a high risk strategy because he has not retaliated, and of course, you know, there will be hawks around him who would have urged retaliation, and he can hold this line for a reasonable time, but if Trump doesn't rescind Obama's measures very quickly after coming to office, Putin is going to come under pressure. And, you know, he's got internal politics in Russia too. He doesn't have, you know, complete power over everybody and everything. Trump, of course, comes to office with a huge and radical agenda, all kinds of things he's promised his voters he's going to do kind of instantaneously. And one has to wonder how far down his to-do list, rescinding Obama's measures against Russian diplomats, closure of Pioneer Point and so on, is going to be. Putin may have quite a weight.
But he has talked about wanting to reset relations with Russia. He's talked very admiringly of Putin in the past. Could it be that what Putin wants most of all is not necessarily those diplomats allowed back into Washington, but those sanctions eased?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Now, whether he will get that, of course, is quite a different question. Trump, you're right, he's spoken admiringly of Putin. One might say quite naively of Putin. But he has also, when Putin talks about developing the Russian nuclear arsenal, made clear that he's prepared to go for an arms race with Russia if that's what Russia wants. So it's not all sunshine and smiles between Trump and Putin. Of course, you know, Putin is cock-a-hoop because the Russians are now claiming that they were the only people to, quote, correctly predict, unquote, Trump's victory. Some people might say orchestrate or even influence it. And they are regarding Trump as their man. Whether he will turn out that way, well, we'll probably find out quite soon.
It's interesting, Brian, that one of the intelligence reports doesn't just say that this was orchestrated at high levels in the Russian government, but says that Vladimir Putin was personally involved in activities to engineer the election of the US president. In a way, it is still faintly astonishing that that hasn't caused more outrage in America.
It is astonishing. It's embarrassing, I think, because this used to be a bipartisan agreement that if a foreign power conducts a cyber attack against your own citizens, that Republican, Democrat, it doesn't matter. You oppose that. And there are consequences to that. And until Donald Trump, that was the case. And this is why Trump's main roadblock in lifting the sanctions and having this new Russian reset is in his own party, where people have for decades opposed Vladimir Putin, or at least since he came to power. And this is something where you're going to have fierce resistance from people like Senator John McCain, who, by the way, was in New Year's Eve. He spent New Year's Eve in Ukraine at a forward operating base with Ukrainian Marines to show them that he stands with them against Putin. And so you have somebody like that who is in Trump's party, who's not going to just roll over and say, okay, let's let the sanctions go. And Trump's going to realize very quickly that this is not something where he just waves a magic wand and U.S. foreign policy resets. I don't know why Donald Trump is so keen on his admiration for an authoritarian thug, but he is. And he's going to have to find out the hard way that most Americans are not. There is a troubling rollback, though, of disdain for Vladimir Putin among Republicans. And this is the thing that I find most shocking about this, is that a poll that was released last week that looked at Trump's voters said that 9% of them had a favorable opinion of Barack Obama. 35% of them had a favorable opinion of Vladimir Putin. This is a guy who kills journalists and dissidents, who rules with an iron fist, and they believe that he is a better figure than the president of the United States, who's just from a different party. And that, to me, is deeply embarrassing about America. In politics, where we have lost our moral compass and have become relativist to an absurd degree, and Donald Trump is chiefly responsible for that.
And of course, those voters who entrusted Donald Trump with the presidency are now expecting him to be the man who can go into the room, stare down Vladimir Putin, and get those deals that he promised that he could get. Now, you know, Trump's name's appeared over any number of casinos in the past, but I get the feeling that Putin is a much more canny and strategic player than Trump is.
He is, but I don't think we even have to accept the premise from the beginning that he's going to stand up to Donald Trump. His Secretary of State nominee has been given the Order of the Friendship of Russia, the highest civilian honor you can get. He's a person who is close with Vladimir Putin's right-hand henchman. So if this person is Rex Tillerson is confirmed, the CEO of ExxonMobil, who Trump's picked to be Secretary of State, the go-between between Trump and Putin is going to be one of Putin's allies. So, I mean, it's a remarkable situation, and it's one that I think means that U.S.-Russian relations might reset. I think that's a very likely possibility. But the reason why the West is not friends with Putin is there's a lot of reasons, right? And it's not just out of a fluke. It's because he's undermining liberal democratic orders around the world and trying to block Western foreign policy wherever it is important to Western actors. So this isn't something that just happens without consequence. It happens with consequence if there is a Russian reset. And if it happens, Vladimir Putin might have a friend in the White House, but Western interests are going to be undermined in a variety of different foreign policy theaters around the world.
John, you get the feeling that Vladimir Putin can't quite believe his luck.
Yes, you do. You get the distinct feeling that Russia as a whole is cock-a-hoop. Russian radio right through today has been crowing over the successes of 2016. That, you know, Trump comes into office and they're talking chip about a reset. Of course, they claim that peace in Syria, again, a complete artifact of Russian diplomacy. And they are talking about, how to say it in English, about much greater respect for Russia in the wider world. In a sixth sense, I suppose they're right. So, yes, I suspect there's been quite a lot of champagne flowing down throats in the Kremlin recently.
Well, we will continue to discuss what Donald Trump's election means, in particular for Europe. We're facing many issues of its own as well in just a moment. Plus, we'll take a look at that new French law, likely to be very popular with anybody whose work phone has buzzed in the dead of night. You're listening to Midori House from Monocle 24. Do stay with us.
Okay, so 2016 wasn't the greatest of years. But don't worry, there are plenty of reasons why 2017 will be better. And we've packed lots of them into more than 250 pages of the new edition of the Monocle Forecast. It's the magazine for those who want to look over the horizon and spot the new opportunities the new year will bring. From the rising global powers to keep an eye on, to the startups to invest in, and the cities you'll want to call home. It's packed with opinion and wit, with ideas and provocations, and guaranteed to keep you talking all the way through 2017. The Monocle Forecast. Buy your copy today and know what's happening tomorrow.
Well, Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Paul Osborne, my guests in the studio, Brian Klass and John Everard. Now, European governments, particularly those in the east of Europe, are closely watching these early diplomatic moves between Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump. But it's not as if they don't have their own problems to worry about, too. 2017 brings elections in France and Germany. It may well bring elections in Italy, too. And then there's always the question of Brexit. Talks on Britain's departure from the EU could start, maybe, in earnest this year. John Everard, if there's one thing that we can absolutely expect this year, it's that the anti-EU sentiment that we saw expressed so very strongly in Britain is going to figure in all of those elections that we mentioned in France and Germany, maybe Italy and Holland. It's going to be a tough year for the EU.
And how? Yes, anti-EU sentiment will figure in all those elections. Let's see just how strong it is. Remember that a lot of people were expecting that sentiment to be reflected in the rerun of the vote for the President of Austria just a few weeks ago. That didn't happen. But I think in the case of France, for example, even if Marine Le Pen is beaten by somebody else in the runoff in the two-tier French system, the fact that she's so likely to get to the second round is itself a very worrying political signal for France. To be honest, I mean, there's all these political concerns over the EU. My take is that the single biggest threat to the EU right now isn't that. It's the state of the Italian banking system. If that does actually go down, and the amounts of money that we are talking are eye-watering, then everything depends on the readiness, effectively, of northern European taxpayers to bail out the Italians. And I suspect there'll be a large gulp, and 2017 might just see the end of the euro.
And, Brian, you have to question whether Europe's leadership class at the moment, is equipped for this anti-EU world, because they've been raised on decades of a broad pro-integration consensus, and now suddenly their populations simply aren't willing to follow them.
That's true, and it's one of the things that creates a huge wrinkle for the Brexit negotiations, because the European leaders that will be involved on the EU side of things have staked their political careers on creating this legacy of European integration. And perversely, punishing Britain and making sure that Britain's experience with Brexit is very bad is the best way to preserve that, because it sends a signal that there are actual real costs to leaving the partnership. So I think we're going to see, you know, 2016 is this year where anti-establishment figures, you know, rose up and populism broke the establishment. I think 2017 is the year where those figures realize how hard it is to govern.
And that, John, you mentioned Norbert Höfer's failure to win the Austrian presidential election, but you also mentioned Marine Le Pen, and those leaders who we associate with the more hardline anti-EU sentiment are not people that would inspire confidence if any of the crises we were discussing earlier when we talked about Trump and Putin were to come to pass. These are not necessarily the people you would want sitting around the table.
I agree entirely. That doesn't mean they won't get elected. I mean, you probably wouldn't choose Donald Trump to be your leader in a crisis, but America's done just that. And I fear that a lot of Europeans may go the same way.
And the defence implications as well of Donald Trump's election, while he may have rowed back a little bit on some of the things he said in the campaign about NATO, if you were Estonia, for example, at the moment, you'd be pretty nervous.
Yeah. Worried sick. I mean, if you read Estonian papers, you know, they are apocalyptic. You know, is this the end of a hard-won independence? Are the Russian tanks about to roll in? They are very, very frightened.
So at the very point when we don't know how committed the United States is to the collective defense principle of NATO, when, John, as you mentioned, the Italian banking system could collapse, hardline anti-EU leaders are poised to make advances in some of the most important countries in Europe, and I hate to return to him, but sitting in the Kremlin laughing his socks off is Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, there are huge risks ahead. I think that everyone's talked about 2016 as this year where everything was going wrong. But the ramifications of the decisions made in 2016 are going to happen in 2017. I mean, the things that were problematic about last year were really at the polls. And now the policies are changing. So, you know, you have a perfect storm of instability because the global balance of power is now going to shift rapidly and potentially in a way that is too rapid to control. And that's what I'm really worried about looking forward.
If I were to paraphrase
shift
the consensus...
rapidly? You mean you think that the power of Russia is going to increase relative to the EU?
No, I don't mean that. I mean that shifting rapidly in terms of how the U.S. backs Russia, right? I think that aspect of a pivot could really change global dynamics in a variety of different regions. Because typically, this sort of detente between Russia and the U.S. has been something that, you know, you could sort of count on the U.S.-EU allies. You could count on the U.S. backing Article 5 of NATO and coming to the defense of Estonia. All of this is under question at the same time that Donald Trump is talking about increasing nuclear capabilities for the United States, increasing defense spending, the European Union is at risk. All of those factors could shift rapidly in a way that's difficult to control. I don't mean specifically that Russia will become more powerful. I think Russia's economy is in very serious risk. But geopolitically speaking, there's a variety of moving pieces that are all moving at the same time in a way that's difficult to predict.
And we haven't even started talking about China.
True.
I have a terrible feeling that the consensus we will be leaving you all with is that 2017 is actually going to be worse than last year. So happy New Year, everybody. The 2nd of January is a public holiday this year in the United Kingdom, but here we all are at work. Now, who doesn't start the new year with a list of resolutions? And often it includes spending more time at home and less dealing with things from the office. You may leave the office on time, but of course your phone and your laptop means the office will never leave you. Unless you happen to live in France, where a new law gives a great many French workers the right to ignore work email out of hours. John, the right to disconnect, according to the French Ministry of Labour, ensures respect for rest periods and a balance between work and family life. I'm not going to argue against that, but I am going to suggest that it's entirely impractical.
I think there will be some problems in implementation, as they say in bureaucratic speak. You're absolutely right. How many bosses are actually going to observe this, and how effective are the controls on companies that simply ignore this new rule? I mean, I think we'll all be watching very carefully to see how it works out, but I have this sinking feeling it might not change that much, in fact.
Would either of you be willing to be out of touch for 16 hours a day?
Absolutely, I do it.
You do it?
I switch one off, yes.
That's incredibly admirable.
Thank you.
Brian?
No, I would not. And it's part of the tragedy of the commons here. I mean, this is something that's going to be a problem for France, too, is what if you switch off but your colleagues don't and they get ahead? And, you know, I've had, you know, you get a media request at 11 p.m. from a U.S. outlet because it's 5 p.m. there and you're glad you had the phone on. So I remember my dad when I was growing up, he was constantly barraged by all these problems. And, you know, we would go to a place that literally did not have cell phone towers so he could get away. So France has found a different mechanism of doing this, and we'll see if they can actually stick to it.
Now, France is, of course, also the home of the 35-hour work week and also a near record high rate of unemployment. Do you think this is going to help or hinder economically?
It's going to hinder economically in the narrow sense of less business being done, people not contributing to their company's output out of hours. But that is simply because the way that we measure economic success is so narrow. It is probably going to reduce levels of stress. It's going to enable people to spend more time with their families. In terms of overall human happiness, it's probably going to improve matters.
Well, Brian, this is what I was thinking, because while on paper, if you're not replying to your emails from 6 p.m. until 9 o'clock the next morning, you're less productive. If you're also not struggling to get to sleep at night because of this flurry of emails at 10:30 at night, or the knowledge that you have six things that you haven't done yet, maybe you'll be a more productive worker the next morning.
I think that's certainly possible. But the question is, in a globalized world, can you just abide by time zones? And so, you know, the high-flying people of the world are in contact with important messages potentially, you know, routinely throughout the day, because there's, you know, when you're asleep, Asia's waking up or whatever. And the question will be, you know, is there a way to create a hierarchy of importance? I mean, I think that's the key for a lot of people. Is there a way to reach you as a fail-safe option where you can turn off all the noise that can wait? And I think that the most successful high-flying people in the world have figured that one out. And we'll see if the average French worker can now, too.
Just briefly, I'd like to see how you both react to this, given that, John, you turn your phone off and, Brian, you don't. 2 years ago, employees of Daimler in Germany were allowed to opt into a policy where every new email that arrived in their inbox when they were on leave was automatically deleted and they would never see it. How do we feel about that, John?
I think it's great to have the option. You could do that in the Foreign Office when I was there. You could switch that, you know, when you're away, emails just vanished. And the system told people who did that, but you had to be brave.
Brian?
I think I would be very worried that I just missed a super important email. I think it's just hard to lose that doubt and hard to just say with confidence, anything that's arrived, I'm just going to disregard.
The very thought of it has brought me out in my first cold sweat of the year, I'm afraid. We will have to end it there. Brian Klass and John Everard, thank you very much for joining us. That is all we have time for on this edition of Midori House. It was produced by Marcus Hippy, researched by Jolene Goff and Angad Benea, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. There's more music in just a moment. Culture with Robert Bound at 1900 here in London. And I'll be back with more on the day's main stories in the Monocle Daily at 2200. Another Midori House at 1800 tomorrow. For now, though, from me, Paul Osborne, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.